All right. Great to see everybody. Everybody's doing well. Tonight, the plan is to very, very briefly overview Hebrews 13, like in 30 seconds, and to summarize Hebrews. And then I'm going to plan on spending the rest of the class on the very interesting history that's recorded in your book, starting on page 75, The Years of Chaos. My original plan was to go over that section kind of quick. You know, it's history, and we don't need to dwell too much on that. And let me get right back to the Bible. We were going to kind of get into Jude. Well, not get into Jude. We were going to overview Jude and sink our teeth in a little bit. But I thought, let's wait on Jude till Sunday. Because this history section, when I started reading through that, it just blew me away at how faith-building it was. Because it gives you so much background on what's going on in, you know, fulfilled prophecy. And so it just, to me, was so uplifting that I thought, well, we have to go into a little bit of detail here. We won't go into the detail that's in the book, but we will be able to go into more detail than I was originally planning. All right? Why don't we start out with a word of prayer? Emery, could you do it just on the spur of the moment for me, please? Thank you.
Our great Father in heaven, we're thankful that we can be here this evening because we get to be with you and other Christians that are wanting to learn more about you. Father, we hope that that our minds will be open and our hearts will be thinking about our souls and about that wondrous reward that we have in heaven. Be with those that are preaching and teaching this evening, and be with us, Father. Forgive us
for
our sins. In
Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right. So, we've been in Hebrews for several classes, and I tried to get through it on Sunday, so we almost did. I had like 2 minutes left. By the time we get to the last chapter of Hebrews, Hebrews 13, the writer of Hebrews has already made his argument, and he has driven home the main point of the book over and over, to remain faithful to Jesus, and especially in chapters 11 and 12. He just drives home that point about remaining faithful. Okay, and then in chapter 13, we just have in verses 1 through 17, just various instructions for Christians about love, about hospitality, about the sanctity of the marriage bed, about depending upon God, about imitating your spiritual leaders, not being carried away by false doctrine, offering our sacrifices to God through Jesus, which, when you know the message of Hebrews, is all the more powerful because he's our high priest, and we offer sacrifices through him. Obey those who watch over your souls. And then closing remarks. So since I wanted to put the majority of our time in the history portion that remains, and since I spent all day preparing for this short class, I did. All day. And I still don't feel prepared. I still could probably spend another hour or two. I want to put our time there. But to summarize the book of Hebrews, we've said it over and over. What is the message of Hebrews? Yes, that's right. Remain faithful to Christ. Do not forsake him no matter what it takes. And what's the main supporting argument?
Because Jesus is superior.
He is superior. He is superior to anything that the law of Moses can offer. All right? So, we really don't need to go into any more there. Well, we could. Hebrews is deep. We can go into a lot of detail there. But for our purposes, we'll move on. Okay? Did anybody have any last, you know, any final word, comment, question from the entire book of Hebrews that you didn't get to make or that you want to make now? Okay? I hope that was an encouraging overview of Hebrews. Very encouraging for me. It was very uplifting for me. Of course, teaching always benefits You always get more when you're the teacher than you do as the student. So I'm getting a lot out of this. All right. So now let's move to the years of chaos. And I'll tell you, I can get carried away with PowerPoint. And I had a lot of fun with it, and I wanted it to be compelling, and probably put a little bit too much work into that, and could have done a little bit more sort of, getting this stuff inside of my head. But I wanted you to see it and not just hear it, because it helps a lot. So these are the years of chaos starting in A.D. 64. Now, we've already talked about the persecutions of Nero. We talked about that at the end of the last quarter, because it seems like that had something to do with the end of Paul's life. Remember? Paul, his final case was heard under Nero, either by Nero himself or someone under him, and he was beheaded. Okay, so we've already discussed some of these things, and we've alluded to and talked about some of this even in this quarter. But we need to talk a little bit more now at this point about Nero's persecution. He was emperor from Rome from A.D. 54 to A.D. 68. And until the time of Nero, the Roman government hadn't discovered that Christianity was a separate religion from Judaism, right? But that was all about to change, right? On July 19th, A.D. 64, a fire broke out, terrible fire broke out, and there were some who thought that the fire might have been instigated by Nero. Many thought that. And so, what did he do? Yeah, he had to find a scapegoat, somebody to blame it on, and so he blamed it on the Christians. And Tacitus, the Roman historian, says this: Nero had self-acknowledged Christians arrested. Then on their information, large numbers of others were condemned, not so much for incendiarism, setting the fire at Rome, as for their antisocial tendencies. Now here the translator adds a note, but this phrase may mean because the human race detested them. But they just seem like the perfect people to blame this on, to Nero. Right? Their deaths were made farcical. Dressed in wild animal skins, they were torn to pieces by dogs, or crucified, or made into torches to be ignited after dark as substitutes for daylight. Nero provided his gardens for the spectacle, and exhibited displays in the circus at which he mingled with the crowd or stood in a chariot dressed as a charioteer. So, we certainly don't have any room to complain, right? Nero's persecution was the first one brought against the church by the Roman government, okay? We talked a lot about that. In the book of Acts, the persecution was from the Jews mainly, and it did not come directly from the Roman Empire, but now it's coming from the Roman Empire. And it's very, very severe. Therefore, this phase of persecution by Rome, well, I skipped something. Okay, I gave you a therefore when there wasn't a therefore to give you. With the death of Nero, the wave of persecution came to a halt. Does anybody know how he died? He committed suicide in A.D. 68, assisted by a former slave. And so, therefore, this phase of persecution by Rome lasted less than 4 years, from A.D. 64 to 68. Now, when you think about his motives for persecuting Christians, his motives were different than some later emperor's motives would be for persecuting Christians. Can you think of what the difference would be between his and others that would come later? Yes. So was he attacking Christians because he wanted to destroy the doctrine of Christ?
No.
He just wanted a scapegoat. He just wanted people to blame for the fires. And they were the perfect people to blame. And so later there would be emperors who would persecute because they were actually trying to destroy the doctrine of Christ. And so that, those persecutions would actually be worse. Okay? Like when we study the book of Revelation and we're at the very end of the first century under Domitian, I mean, it was empire-wide. At this point, it might have taken on a wider scope than just Rome, but it wasn't, in general, it wasn't empire-wide. Okay? So that's a difference too. Lydon's here. Hey, Lydon. I don't know if y'all saw Lydon, but I'm excited. Lydon gives me energy, and he gives me joy. He's a good guy. So I'm glad to see you back. All right. So now let's talk about the Jewish wars from AD 66 to 70. During the same years that the church was being persecuted by Nero, rebellion broke out in Judea in AD 66. All right. The chief source of information about the Jewish wars is what man?
Josephus.
All right, so Josephus. All right, you're going to hear his name a lot in this class. And if you're not already familiar with him, I'm going to tell you about it right now. But you really have to know about Josephus because of the important history that he provides. He was a Jew, and he played an active role in these wars. And therefore, he could give a personal account of the events. And that's what he does. Very detailed. And in his own autobiography, he relates that not only was he of a priestly descent, his family was part of the 24 courses of priests. So that's the kind of a person that he was. Very Jewish, okay? He was born in A.D. 37. Now think about how close in proximity that is to the death of Jesus. Okay, so we're not many years away from the death of Jesus and the beginning of the early church. He had chosen to become, does anybody know which sect of the Pharisees? I mean, of the Jews? He became a Pharisee. Okay, I saw Ms. B mouthing it, so very good. By the time he was an adult, the situation in Judea had gotten very bad. When the wars began, and we're going to talk about all that, he became a military leader. Josephus did, in Galilee, and he was captured, and he saw that, you know what, there's no way that the Jews are going to defeat the Romans, and so he tried to encourage them, you know, to lay down their arms, and they viewed him, therefore, as a traitor, okay? Kind of reminds me, in a way, of, you know, Jeremiah's message when Babylon was a threat was, hey, submit to Nebuchadnezzar, things are going to be better for you, and they're like, we're not having any of this. And they rebelled against Jeremiah. So he was actually only trying to help. But he was hated by the Jews. He was hated by the Romans. Kind of hated by everybody. The Jews resented the Romans from the moment Pompey, the Roman general, first entered their city in A.D. 63. So they had all this resentment. And in response to their attitude, the Romans considered that whole area of Palestine to be a trouble spot in constant turmoil. And it was. There's always some riot breaking out, you know, among the Jews. In fact, when Jesus was crucified, it was basically, it came down to one man deciding to have him crucified because he didn't want to lose his job. Right? Pilate, he was afraid of a riot breaking out. And so he decided to have Jesus crucified. And so there were always riots breaking out. There was always all this tension between Jews and Rome. Not always, but... Okay, so the Romans determined to hold control over Palestine because they intended to be over the whole Mediterranean Sea. Herod the Great, of course he was dead by this point in the 60s, but... he had convinced the Romans that they must allow the Jews to keep their own law and to worship their God according to that law, or else what was he telling them, you know, the government might happen?
Rebellion.
So you've got to allow them to observe their own religion. And so they took his advice, and that actually helped. Conditions were pretty bad in Judea under Herod's rule, but they only got worse after he died. So anarchy grew, and a spirit of rebellion grew. Josephus says, and thus the flame was every day more and more blown up till it came to a direct war. It's interesting to read about the zealots. Now, you know that one of the apostles was a zealot. Who was that?
Simon
the Zealot. But Josephus talked about these Sicarii, and they slew men in the daytime and in the midst of the city. This they did chiefly at festivals, when they mingled themselves among the multitudes and concealed daggers under their garments, with which they stabbed those who were their enemies. These were Jewish terrorists attacking these Greeks. So that kind of thing was going on a lot. There was a lot of thievery. Now remember in Acts where Paul stood before Felix, and then Felix was succeeded by, remember another? Well, we do have Agrippa in Acts 26, but he was succeeded by Festus, okay? But you're right, we're going to talk about Agrippa, Mr. Phil. When Festus succeeded Felix, he managed to stop the greater part of the robbery. But when he was succeeded by Albinus, Albinus became one of the thieves. To make matters worse, the guy that followed him, his name was Gessius Florus. Now, we're going to talk about Gessius Florus, so don't worry about all those other names right now, but try to remember Florus, okay? Because we're going to talk quite a bit about him. He's a major reason for the Jewish Wars, as we're going to find out. He was the kind of man that made Albinus appear to be, you know, really good. Josephus lists many heinous deeds that Florus did, and convincingly argues that it was him that was responsible, really, for starting these Jewish wars. All right, so the spark that began the revolt was an incident that occurred in Caesarea, which was the center of Roman control over the land. All right? Now, y'all don't get tired. I know this is a lot of information, and I'm sorry you have to listen to me. I'd get tired if I had to listen to me for an hour straight, or for 45 minutes. Nero had given Greeks the local administration of Caesarea, so they were in charge of the courts and public affairs. All right, so you got the Greeks, they're in control here. The Jews had a synagogue in Caesarea. They rented it from a Greek. They wanted to buy the building, but he never allowed them to do that. And not only that, but he continued to build shops around the synagogue and even inside of the synagogue. So they're just left with this really narrow strip to worship. And one Sabbath, as the Jews were crowding into their synagogue, do you remember what story you read about in the book? What happened? A Greek took an urn, a large urn, turned it upside down, and what did he do? He offered birds right in the entrance to the synagogue, which defiled the whole area for them. Well, as if that wasn't bad enough, there was also another aspect of what he did that was particularly offensive. Do you remember what the book said about that?
It was a sacrifice for lepers.
Yes. So that act of offering those birds was perhaps an insinuation that the Jewish nation was a leprous nation, because the sacrifice of a bird was part of the offerings commanded for the cleansing of a leper. That was very upsetting to the Jews, so provoking that a riot broke out. And the Jews went to Florus, that low-down, good-for-nothing Roman governor of Judea. They paid him 8 talents to fix the problem. Well, that was a really bad choice. He was happy to take their money. That was a lot of money. 1 talent is worth 15 to 20 years worth of labor. So they paid him 8 talents. And so he did nothing. He took their money and he did nothing. They came to him and complained about this problem. And do you remember what he did? There's some of them in the prison. And so the Jews in Jerusalem could hardly control themselves about this. And then he demanded that 17 talents be paid to him from the temple treasury. And then a great commotion and resistance erupted. I think he was just trying to stir them up. He already had it out for the Jews. And so he assembled an army to go to Jerusalem and take care of this problem. All right, Florus turned his men loose on the city after, you know, wreaking havoc as he was approaching the city. They plundered and killed not only in the streets, but also in the homes. They brought captives to Florus. He ordered them whipped and crucified, even children. He even crucified Jews who were Roman citizens. This guy was, he was bad. So Florus continued to oppress the Jews until finally he tried to take the Tower of Antonia. You remember us talking about that in the class on Acts? It was connected to the temple area, okay, in the corner. And so he tried to take the Tower of Antonia and tried to take the temple, which means the temple area. It's like 40-something acres. The violent response of the Jews drove his forces back, and they blocked all of the passageways between the tower and the temple area. And so this caused Florus to kind of step back a little bit, and he left a cohort of soldiers, and he returned back to Caesarea. Okay? Now, of course, the Jews at this point are really stirred up. And you've always got the hotheads, right? It doesn't matter if it's one against a thousand, they're just going to go and they're going to fight. So you've got these more rebellious Jews start making strikes against military targets. They also killed the garrison of Roman soldiers in Jerusalem. And so these hotheads drove the Jewish nation right into war. And that's often how these kind of things, you know, occur. It's not that the whole nation was ready for that, but you had some who were ready for it, so they just went and did it. As the terrorists made attacks on the Gentiles, that, of course, provoked a violent response from Rome. And so in many cities in Palestine, thousands of Jews were being slaughtered. Sometimes as many as, 20,000 in Caesarea. Finally, Cestius Gallus, that governor of Syria that we talked about, that I mentioned earlier, I don't think I have mentioned him. He was in the notes earlier, but I hadn't mentioned him yet. He was forced to act, okay, because Syria is right there close. So he's got to do something about all this. It's going to affect him and his nation. So assembling a large army, he made his way into Jerusalem. And coming to the upper city, he was almost victorious. He could have ended this whole thing, and there wouldn't have been any more fighting afterwards. But he just turned and retreated. And there's not really a good reason why he did that. But during that interim, while the Roman forces were away, many of the prominent Jews fled the city. Now, this is where it starts becoming faith-building to me. Many of the prominent Jews fled the city as if it were a ship about to sink. And listen to what Jesus said. You can read it from your own Bible if you want in Matthew 24:14 and 15. Jesus said, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Isn't that something? That was, 40 years. 30-something years before all this was happening. In the parallel account in Luke, Jesus said, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near." Eusebius, the church father, said, "The whole body, however, of the church at Jerusalem, having been commanded by a divine revelation given to men of approved piety there before the war, removed from the city and dwelt at a certain town beyond the Jordan called Pella." Historical fact. Why did they do that? Because they remembered Jesus' words. How could Jesus have foreseen that? He was Jesus. He was divine. That's powerful to me. That's very faith-building to me. Nero. Now, does anybody have any comments? I know I'm just kind of taking it, and I've got to kind of do that in this class, but I'll pause here for a minute. I haven't put anybody to sleep yet, so I guess that's pretty good. Anybody have any comments or questions at this point? It's good, because I probably wouldn't know the answer. I'm still learning a lot of this. This is not my forte, but we'll make it work.
Got a question.
Uh-oh.
I've heard that said that not a Christian was killed in that when Jerusalem was taken over.
Because they had fled?
That's interesting. Said that.
I've never heard that said before. It'd be hard to prove, but that's. I think the force of that is to say that they had listened to the words of Jesus. So, good.
They would have had to do it in a timely way, because I imagine at some point the chance to do that stopped.
Yeah.
And so I have faith that they were given that opportunity.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, in Matthew 24, he says, pray that you may not, pray that it may not come on a Sabbath. Why? They closed the gates on the Sabbath. You couldn't get out of the city. You weren't going to climb over those walls. And he said, woe to those who are pregnant and who are nursing babies. Well, some people think Matthew 24 is talking about the end of time. Does that make any sense? Woe to those who are pregnant at the end of time. No. Woe to those who are pregnant and nursing babies whenever these armies come, and they're coming, because it's going to be hard for you to travel. And so don't look back. You know, don't turn around and go back in your house to get something. Get out. That's not talking about the rapture. You know? Okay, well, anyway. All right, good thoughts. I've got some sermons. I might need to get up on that now that we're kind of talking about Matthew 24, because that's very important that we understand about the end times and how people mix that in with Matthew 24. I think that Matthew 24 does have some references to the end times, because the destruction of Jerusalem foreshadowed what's going to happen at the end of the world. And so Jesus uses that to then pivot, and I think in the second half of the chapter, in Matthew 25 with the parable of the talents and so forth, and the sheep and the goats, he is talking about the end of time. But the first part in Matthew 24 is not talking about the end times. Not talking about the rapture. The rapture is not found in the Bible. I'm going off, okay? So I'm going to try not to do that. There is a rapture in the Bible in 1 Thessalonians 4. But that's not talking about the rapture as it is taught in popular consumer Christianity. Okay? Okay, we'll get into that some other time. All right. Nero sent Vespasian, who was his general, into Judea to go and finish off these Jews. It's just, it has now come to Nero making that decision. I've got to put a stop to this. So soon the general arrived in Judea. By now it was AD 67. So think about that in reference to when Jerusalem was destroyed. When was Jerusalem destroyed? AD 70. Okay, so this is just a few years before that, AD 67. Who was Vespasian's son who joined him in the battle? Titus. Okay? Titus joined his father with a great army in the very early spring of the next year. It was around this early time of when, you know, Judea was being invaded by the Roman armies that Josephus in the city of Jotapata surrendered to Vespasian. Okay? So this is that time. The Romans continued to take important cities throughout the country. And meanwhile, the situation in Jerusalem kept getting worse. It just kept deteriorating into more and more lawlessness. So I'm going to skip a little information in your book. I'm kind of on page 82. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff. About midway in the book there, on that page there. Meanwhile, Vespasian continued taking cities. And he finally turned his attention to Jerusalem itself. But while he was busy making his preparations for that siege, what did he hear of? Something terrible had happened at the very highest levels of the Roman Empire.
Nero died.
And so he delayed any further action until he learned what was going to happen in Rome. Well, when Nero died, as you can expect, civil unrest just broke out in Rome. And over the next 2 years, 68 and 69, how many emperors were there? All right, there were three, and actually four if we're going to count Vespasian. So it finally wound up with Vespasian, who had been the general, becoming the emperor in AD 69. Okay, so we're kind of fast-forwarding to there. So now it's AD 69. You've got Vespasian, who used to be the general. He's now the emperor, and who is the general? Titus, his son. And so Vespasian sets out once he is confirmed as emperor. He's in Egypt. He goes to Rome and sends Titus to go and destroy Jerusalem. That job is still got to be finished, right? So he gathers all of his forces together in Caesarea, Titus does, and then soon he's on his way to Jerusalem. Josephus specifically mentions the flags, the incense, with the eagles atop the poles that the army carried with them. So that's neat. That's just a neat little detail that Josephus mentions. Titus sets up camp on Mount Scopus in the site of Jerusalem. And then begins the siege. Now, we're not going to go into the details, but Josephus goes into the details. Starvation, sedition, murder and sedition within the walls, and the army, of course, sieging from the outside. Tortured fellow Jews within the city tortured one another because they were hungry and they wanted to find out where food was. So they did unspeakable acts toward one another just to get food, as you can imagine, because that's what a siege does. It starves you out. Also, by this time, the wrath of the Romans had been thoroughly aroused. Many Jews had sneaked out of the city looking for food. The Romans captured them, whipped them, and tortured them, and crucified them before the walls at a rate of 500 or more Jews per day until they ran out of wood to crucify anybody on. As the siege drew to a close, the daily sacrifice at the temple ceased to be offered. This was prophesied in Daniel 9:27, 500 years before the time of Christ, that the sacrifice would cease to be offered. That's faith building. Then the temple was destroyed. It was burned to the ground in AD 70. The destruction of the temple didn't end the battle, but it wasn't long until the rest of the city was taken. After a siege of 143 days, the Romans took many captives, and in the 7 years that led up to the destruction of Jerusalem, close to 1,400,000 Jews had been killed. In the siege alone, well over 1 million were killed. It's hard to even begin to fathom the atrocities, to what that must have been, to what Josephus must have witnessed. Josephus records this. For all the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those who dug it up on the foundation that there was nothing left to make those that came thither believe it had ever been inhabited. You imagine? Going and looking around and being like, man, anybody ever lived in this place? That's how thoroughly Jerusalem was just completely annihilated. It was at this very point. Now, I want to think about Daniel 9 with you for a second. This is a hard passage, okay? But turn there with me. I'll try to simplify it because I'm left with more minutes than I thought. Well, I got a few. Okay, Daniel chapter 9. Daniel lived through the period of the Babylonian captivity. Does everybody know what the Babylonian captivity is referring to? This is when God was so fed up with his people that he took them out of the land into Babylon. And so they're in Babylon for 70 years. Jeremiah had prophesied that in Jeremiah chapter 25. Well, Daniel had been studying the book of Jeremiah. And he knew that it was 70 years of captivity. And he was doing math. Well, those 70 years were just about up. So he started praying, asking God to forgive the nation, asking God to restore the nation, and for the return from captivity to happen, because that had been promised. A remnant shall return, right? And he's worried about the temple, because it had been annihilated in 587. It had been destroyed during the captivity by Babylon. So he was praying that it would be rebuilt, that the city would be rebuilt, okay? Now, I'm going to read this, but I don't want you to get lost in the details. I don't think this is a literal prophecy in terms of weeks, because it mentions weeks. They're not literal. I think it's very general. But look at the things that would happen, okay? Starting verse 24, this is Gabriel's answer to Daniel, who's so concerned about Jerusalem. 70 weeks, very symbolic number, have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, which was under Cyrus, king of Persia, until Messiah. You see that? Messiah, the anointed one, the prince. There will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Don't worry about that part. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, again, don't worry about the number, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. I think the prince to come is in reference to Rome. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on those, on the one who makes desolate. So the basic progression of things that will happen is, okay, the city is going to be rebuilt, Daniel. Take heart. There's going to be a long period of time and Messiah, the prince, is going to come. He's going to be cut off. And not too long after that, the temple, the city, is going to be destroyed. And it will never have an important place in God's plan again. That was made in Jewish scripture 500 years before Christ ever came. I'm getting chill bumps on my bald head right now, you know? I'm telling you, that just fires me up. It's just so cool. In Matthew 24:15, I just want to read that. I had that written in my notes in my Bible, and I wasn't planning on reading it, but since I have it written there. Matthew 24 and verse 15. Read this verse with me. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, we read that earlier, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Jesus was applying Daniel's prophecy to what event? The destruction of Jerusalem. Therefore, we have no right to take Daniel's prophecy and turn it into an end-time speculative, you know, circus like people want to do. So, anyway, real quick, a couple of other things. When the destruction of Jerusalem happened, the Jewish archives were taken, destroyed. With the archives gone, no one could trace his ancestry again to prove which tribe he fit into. So the nation was rejected by God and their holy temple was destroyed forever. There's no way to kind of go back now and retrace all that. It was destroyed. All these things were in fulfillment of the prophecies of Christ. Not only of Daniel, but also of Christ. Remember what he said in Matthew 24:1-2? And he said to them, to his disciples, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. It happened just like he said. The house that had once belonged to God had indeed been left desolate.
The Roman soldiers even went through and pried up all the paving stones and foundation stones. Because when they burnt the temple, there was a bunch of gold in it, and it melted down in the cracks in the floor.
Wow.
And they went back and pried up everything.
Wow. That's interesting. I did not know that. So, the Jewish people, really this wasn't a matter of just skirmishes between, you know, the Jewish nation and the Roman Empire. This was that the Jews had rejected the Christ. That's what this all really came down to. And he told them that this would happen because of that. And that's exactly what God did. The destruction of Jerusalem stands out in the history of mankind because it was the destruction of the city where God had put his name. It was the destruction that marked God's vengeance upon a wicked people who had once been his chosen possession. Today, Jerusalem is of no more value than any other city on earth to God. The Jews continue as an ethnic group, but they will be saved or lost depending on what? That's it. That's what it comes down to. So, that's the class. Okay? I hope it was helpful in some small way. Thank you for your attention. I don't care if you want to do it now, that's fine. I just have one little thing to say. For next class, just read through page 97. So that's going to get you through Jude and then the introduction to 1 John. Okay? So please study Jude. That's not a book we really study much or talk about much or quote much. Well, I really want to encourage you to study it, meditate on it. All right. Thanks, everybody.